Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So we're going to start by just talking about the fact that the brain changes. And this includes when we form habits. So when we form habits, the brain changes. And that vice and virtues are habits, as defined by Aquinas. And then we're just going to, because the talk is relatively short, we're just going to focus on two related virtues and two related vices. So we're going to focus on humility and magnanimity as the two virtues. And then we're going to focus on two vices, pride and vainglory. And then we're going to look at some practical steps and how we can grow in these things. Okay. So the brain, I've dedicated much of my life to studying this and trying to fix the brain when things go wrong with it. That's my main job as a neurologist. And the brain is just overwhelmingly complex for anyone. There are 86 to 100 billion neurons in the human brain. And every neuron has potentially 10,000 connections, which means there's a quadrillion connections in the brain, which is just staggering. We think of neurons as maybe just one thing, but there are actually hundreds of different types of neurons as well that have different functions. We don't understand how they all work. There's much that we don't understand. When we think about neuroscience, there's what we actually know, and we know a ton. We can fill libraries with information of what we know about the brain, but then there's also what could potentially be known. And the gap between that, I think, is enormous. There is so much. Neuroscience, I think, is still somewhat in its infancy. And we'll know a lot more as time goes on. There are still diseases that perplex us that we haven't figured out how to cure because we don't understand the pathophysiology of the diseases. So there's a lot of growth to happen within the field of neuroscience. One of the things I do, just because neuroscientists do a very bad job at this, I did just want to start by maybe just clarifying some terminology, because we can talk about the brain in a very reductive way. So I'm giving a lecture right now, and I'm using expressive language to do this. I'm expressing myself. I'm speaking to you all. And there are different ways that we can describe that. There's a role in which neuroscience can describe this activity that I'm doing, and then there's roles that are more suitable for philosophy. So as I'm speaking to you, I could explain to you the what we call the material cause. I could tell you what areas in my brain are active right now. So my left inferior frontal gyrus is an area in my brain that would be very active right now as I'm speaking to you. And from there, there's various connections. And then the cortical bulbar tract, and that comes down to my brainstem and innervates various cranial nerves. And those cranial nerves go to the muscles in my mouth, my tongue, uvula, palate, so that I can articulate. So those are like, that's the matter. That's the stuff involved in me speaking to you. And neuroscience has great expertise in that. But then you may wonder, and we'll talk about this a little bit, what's going on inside of those structures? What kind of gives this effect to where I can speak? What's happening at a cellular level to bring about this action of speaking? So we're getting to the efficient cause of the matter. So we talk about how neurons have certain ions that come into them, which cause depolarization, which just means the nerves fire. We can talk about various neurotransmitters and such. So we're talking about the efficient cause. Again, neuroscience has expertise in that area. But let's say you guys leave here and someone asks you on the street, hey, what did that guy talk about today? And you're like, you only explain it through material and efficient causality. So you're like, well, you know, his inferior frontal gyrus on the left was really depolarizing, which sent, you know, these signals to his cortical bulbar tract, and glutamate was released. And like, this would be completely meaningless, okay? I mean, it has some meaning, but it's not going to tell them anything of what the content was. That's what they're getting at. What was the meaning of what he said? What was the content? What were the ideas that were expressed in the message, okay? What was the shape and contour of what he said? What we're getting at there is formal causality, what the form is, what the structure is, the intelligibility of the thing, okay? That is not part of neuroscience. And then we also talk about the purpose of a thing, the teleology. Like, why did he give this lecture, right? Again, that's part of more of a philosophical lens. It's very common that neuroscientists think that everything can be reduced to material and efficient causes. So then it kind of leads to this absurdity that you have brains that talk, brains that see, fusiform gyri that recognize faces, brains that go on dates, ventral medial prefrontal cortexes that break up with their girlfriend. But the brain doesn't do these things or have these qualities. These are qualities that people have who use their brains to do these things. And that's a very important distinguishing feature. So during this talk, if I do personify the brain in such a way, it's just a shorthand of saying this. I don't actually think that the brain has these human qualities. Okay? All right. So that's just a clarification. So we can get going. All right. So the first kind of premise that I wanted to describe is that the brain changes. And this may seem obvious to us now, but this was, within neuroscience circles up until maybe even the 80s, this was a heretical idea that the brain changed. So it was thought that the brain was immutable. It did not change. And this was dogma. So then there are certain experiments that occurred that started to dismantle this, and now it's, I would say, a fact. We know with certainty that the brain changes, and it's always changing. Okay, so I'm going to try to talk about that a little bit. So one example is a study from around the year 2000 where there is a group of cab drivers that are referred to as London Black Cabbies, and they have to go through this test called the knowledge. It takes several years, but you have to memorize about 25,000 streets in the London area and all the landmarks. And this takes several years, and then you're tested on it. You have a very rigorous written exam as well as an oral exam. And many people don't pass this, but if you do pass this, you have the honor and privilege of being a London Black Cabbie. So neuroscientists thought, well, this would be a great group of people to study. So what we find is as you go through the knowledge, as you go through this really rigorous task, they can actually measure the changes that occur in the hippocampus. So the posterior hippocampus on the right has to do with spatial memory. So if you guys can get around without a GPS through New York City, then you have like a pretty good spatial memory. But as we use GPS systems, that area of our brain atrophies, and we become less able to get around, okay? Which is maybe be a problem someday. So they measured this, and what they found was in these people who passed the test, and then there's multiple studies after this, but as they learn this information, the volume of their posterior hippocampus is actually enlarging, and they have a greater capacity to navigate. So that's just one example. The next one is Daredevil, who is from around here. And our occipital lobes, so our occipital lobes give us the capacity to be able to see. And the occipital lobes, or vision, takes up maybe like 30 to 50% of our cerebral cortex. There's a huge amount of our brain that's dedicated to vision, right? So you think, okay, well, what does the occipital cortex do in someone who's blind, right? Does it do nothing? Well, if someone is born blind or if they become blind during their life, the occipital cortex will actually start doing things like processing sound, which should be the temporal lobe. So that's why it allows people who are blind to echolocate, like Daredevil. So you make a click sound, and the clicks will bounce off of objects. And instead of going to Herschel's gyrus in the temporal lobe to be processed, it goes there, but it also goes to the occipital lobe. And if you do like transcranial magnetic stimulation and you deactivate the occipital lobe, blind people can no longer echolocate. So you see that the occipital lobe, if I were to personify it, would say like, okay, I can't see, so what else can I do with this? Okay, I can process memories. I can feel things. So it will start to incorporate new skills, which is really cool. So you're actually able to make devices because of this. So these are these tactile vision substitution systems. So with blind individuals, you can put a device on the tongue, and there's a camera attached. The camera sees the image and will send a certain pattern of vibrations to the blind person's tongue. And the blind person will be able to kind of see. So they can actually ride bicycles and catch balls and do things like that based off of this information that's being processed in the occipital lobe. So it's really quite fascinating. But this is all possible because the brain changes, because the brain adapts. Within my own field, kind of those things for which I have more expertise in is neurological diseases. And one of the worst neurological diseases that almost entirely affects children is what's called Rasmussen's encephalitis, which I've treated patients with this. But this is an inflammatory autoimmune condition that attacks one cerebral hemisphere in young children. And it causes an intractable form of epilepsy. So they'll have hundreds of seizures a day. And eventually this will kill them, and their brain will start to atrophy on that side. They'll develop what we call like contralateral hemiparesis, so they'll start to lose muscle strength on the opposite side. And the only way for these children to survive is to remove that hemisphere of the brain. And you think, well, let's say it's the left hemisphere. Well, the left hemisphere gives us the capacity to speak and to understand and to move the right side of our body and to run and so many other things, to read, to write. So you would think, okay, this person's not going to be able to walk. They're not going to be able to move the right side of their body. They're not going to be able to use language. They're not going to be able to understand. However, when you do this, if you do this, say, on someone who's less than the age of 3 who develops this disorder, and it usually does happen very early in life, they pretty much have a completely normal outcome. So this is an example of a girl who has half of a brain. She had her left hemisphere removed, but she developed normal intelligence. She can run and play. She can speak. She has normal social cognition. She has normal emotions. They go to college. They have careers. So they live normal lives. Now, if we were to do this with a 20-year-old, the story would be very different. But in someone under the age of 3, they may have some dexterity issues, but mostly they're going to recover. They're going to do quite well. In the field of stroke, so I do neurological emergencies, and stroke is what I probably do the most of. We talk to patients who have had strokes, who maybe are paralyzed on one side of the body, they've lost language capacities and such, and they may be even in their 60s or 70s. But if you survive your stroke, you're going to get better. I can't predict if you'll get 100% better or 80% better. That part's a little bit harder, but you are going to improve. But you're not going to improve because new neurons have generated or the neurons that have suffered from a stroke have actually come back to life again. No, other pathways are going to open up that have laid dormant. You're going to get cortical remapping so that other areas of the brain are going to take on responsibilities that they didn't have previously. You're going to get axons that are going to sprout from neurons. New dendrites are going to form. It's like if you're in the city of New York and they're doing construction, they'll set up a detour, right? Or they should. So this detour is set up and you work around it, right? And as you continue down that path, you get more used to it and it gets better, right? So this is how the brain works. So these are all examples of what we call neuroplasticity. So neuroplasticity refers to the brain's ability to change and adapt throughout life in response to experiences, learning, injury, or environmental changes. It involves the strengthening or weakening of neural connections, the formation of new pathways, and structural changes in the brain. Neuroplasticity underlines learning. So if you're learning a new language, if you're learning new habits, this is neuroplasticity. If you're recovering from a stroke, okay? So, yeah, if it wasn't for this, my stroke patients wouldn't get better, and we would never learn anything. So there are many different types of neuroplasticity, and this is not an exhaustive list. This is categorical, but within each category, there are several different types. I am not going to go through this in great depth, because we would be here for a whole semester, and you probably don't want that. So, but yeah, there are different categories, but much of neuroplasticity, not all of it, but much of it relies upon this first category called synaptic plasticity, specifically what's called long-term potentiation and long-term depression. I'm going to talk about that very simply, just a little bit. But you can think of the brain as a garden, okay? So, thank you. You can think of the brain as a garden. And you can think of something like habits. So imagine planting a seed. So let's say that you're walking through New York City and you're not a very generous person, but you suddenly feel a sense to be generous. So you see a homeless man reach out his hand and you give the homeless man $5. This isn't really a virtue that you have, to be generous, but this act just planted a seed, okay? And you do it a couple more times. And then all of a sudden, you start saying, you know what, every Tuesday, I'm just gonna go to the ATM and I'm just gonna take out like $5 bills. And every day that I walk between this time to work, I'm just gonna give someone $5, right? So what are you doing? Now, you planted that seed, you planted that kind of habit, and now you're watering it, and it's starting to grow, okay? So you're starting to cultivate this. Things are starting to kind of grow. So it's like water and sunlight. And you start to become a generous person through this process, okay? So you're forming a habit of generosity. As you do that, however, there are certain other areas that maybe parts of the garden that aren't as functional that are diminishing. So let's say greed. So you're becoming a less greedy person, right? So you're kind of pruning away that part of the garden. You're getting rid of it and you're replacing it with something else. Okay, so you can think of the brain in that way. So if I talk a little bit about just very simply long-term potentiation and long-term depression. That'll be the only neuroplasticity I talk about. All right, hopefully I can explain this clearly. So imagine that you have two neurons, and I have an inaccurate picture of two neurons. This actually, I didn't look at this when I put it on here, but there are some mistakes, which is regrettable, but perhaps hopefully you will not catch them. All right. So imagine this. So you have one kind of neuron here and you have one neuron here. And the idea is neurons that fire together wire together. That's the cliche in neuroplasticity. So you have what's called the end of one neuron. We call that an axon terminal. And then the next neuron that it wants to communicate with has dendrites, these like finger projections that receive signals from neuron A. Okay, so we want this connection between these two neurons, what's called the synapse, to be as strong as possible. So what has to happen for this connection to get stronger or for this next neuron to fire is neuron A needs to release a chemical called glutamate. So you have glutamate, it's released into the synaptic cleft. And then on the other side, you have these doors that are called AMPA receptors. So they're just little doors. And the glutamate is key. So the glutamate's released as a key and it opens the door of the AMPA receptors. And when that happens, sodium is going to rush into the cell through the front door. And now the neuron B can now fire. Okay, hopefully that makes sense. So that's great. But neurons, they can fire up to 500 times a second. So if the neuron is firing in a repetitive action, then what's going to happen is there's this other receptor that's really the game changer. And that receptor is called an NMDA receptor, but it's blocked by magnesium. But as it fires, if it gets strong enough, the magnesium is going to bump off and the NMDA receptor becomes a window that's now open. And glutamate is going to rush in, and then there's going to be signal pathways that start opening up. And then from that, you're going to start getting more connections with other neurons, and you're actually going to start making more dendrites and all sorts of things. Anytime you're learning something, like right now, if you're learning from this lecture, that is what's happening. Okay, that underlies most of neuroplasticity. So anytime you're learning a language, if you're becoming more generous, whatever it is, that's the mechanism which is occurring, for better or for worse. Long-term depression is the opposite of that. Long-term depression is when you stop using a particular vice or virtue. It's kind of a use it or lose it. It's going to start being pruned away, which can be a good thing. All right. So I just wanted to say that the brain changes. I talked a little bit about how the brain changes. And the next part is I'd like to talk a little bit about St. Thomas Aquinas and the idea of a habit. Okay? So a habit is a stable disposition to act in a certain way. So I gave generosity as an example of that. A habit is a stable quality that disposes a human faculty, like the intellect or will, towards a particular action. Okay? It makes our powers operate more easily and consistently. So as we continue to be generous, it's easier to become generous, and you become a generous person. In short, a habit is a lasting tendency that shapes how we think, choose, and act. So now, Aquinas would say that virtues and vices are habits. Okay, so a virtue is a good habit. A vice is a bad habit. This should be obvious. Okay, all right. So I'll give you like an example. You probably don't need one because it's very obvious, but like overeating. So, which is a problem that I have. I just have like a good metabolism. So I've weighed the same since middle school, but I eat a tremendous amount of food. But I saw that this was a problem. So I said, I need to be more temperate. I need to change this. So then I restricted sweets, and I had a cheat day on Sunday. But then it wasn't working well. I went to this get-together after Mass, and they made these like homemade donuts. And it was Sunday, so I was like, well, great, it's my cheat day. I can have some donuts. So I walked by, and I grabbed a donut. And I ate it, and I was like, that was amazing. And they were the best donuts I've ever had. And so then, like 10 minutes later, I got this like dopamine hit, and I was like, I'm just going to go check on my kids inside. And I ate another donut. So then like 20 minutes goes by, and I'm like, I think I need to use the bathroom. So then I go inside, walk by the donuts, and I'm like, that third donut looks good. So I ate another donut. I ate 7 donuts. And like, this is gluttony. So I realized that this is a problem. This is a big problem. So I was like, I need to practice temperance. So that's moderating desires and impulses, in this case, for food. So, and you do that using your intellect. So when we use our intellect, correlated with that, there's a lot of things that happen in our prefrontal cortex. So especially what's called the dorsal lateral prefrontal cortex and the ventral medial prefrontal cortex. And it requires a lot of cognitive energy to deliberate, to make moral decisions, to work things. It's much easier to work, to kind of act on an impulse. Like that requires no effort whatsoever. But things like virtue, when you're relying upon the cognitive demands of your prefrontal cortex, it can be kind of exhausting and we fail. But I was like, okay, how can I do this? This is what I'm going to do. At dinner time, when I'm with my children, while we are eating, I'm going to read the gospel for the day to my children, and we're going to discuss the gospel reading as a family, and that's going to slow me down and make me more cognizant. So I started doing that. And after doing that for many months, I have now kind of built that habit of temperance. And it becomes second nature. Now, what happens neurologically is, imagine riding a bicycle. When you first start riding a bicycle, you have to think about it. You have to be like, okay, I need to like I just taught one of my daughters how to ride a bicycle. And it's like, you have to push down on the pedal. And it's like, it for her, if she pushes backward, it breaks. And she just keeps doing it. So I'm like, no, you've got to push forward. And it's just like, it's a really hard task for her to do this. But she has to like think about it. But then once you start to learn to ride a bike, you don't have to think about it anymore. That's exactly how habits work. So what happens there is, when she's learning how to ride a bicycle, she's trying to reason and use her intellect. But then there's going to be connections that form with her dorsal striatum, which are in her basal ganglia. And that's more automatic stuff. So we don't have to think about that. When we practice virtues, when you become a generous person, you don't have to think about being generous. It just happens automatically. Okay. So that's one of like, that's kind of the mechanism which occurs. So when we talk about pride, so if we focus in on pride, so we naturally desire excellence, according to St. Thomas, and that's good. God is excellent, and we're drawn to be like him. But it's how we desire excellence that matters. So if you desire excellence rightly, under reason's rule, then that's virtue, that's noble ambition. If you desire less than you should, this can't be the right translation, but small-souled cowardice. That just seems so insulting. If someone ever said that to me, I'd just be like, oh. If you desire more than is right, that's pride. So pride, then, is when we seek to exalt ourselves beyond our proper measure. In other words, it's a disordered desire for excellence. We overestimate ourselves. And this often, or just does, result in love of self over God, and this corrupts all virtues. So as you become prideful, you're less concerned with other people, which makes it very unlikely you're going to be generous, right? Unless you're doing it for vainglory. But then that's not really generosity. You're unlikely to show mercy. You're unlikely to be compassionate, right? So, you just start lacking proper regard for other people. So this is what's called a default mode network, and this is people spend like maybe eight hours a day or so in this, but this is where we do self-referential thinking. So that's thinking about yourself, about your past, about your future, but not the present moment, about various emotional states, how you're feeling at the moment, and your personal identity. So all humans spend a lot of time in those networks. It's where your mind wanders, where you daydream, and it's where you kind of superficially think of other people. So like, say you have a party at your house, and you're like, oh, I hope Susan liked the cookies. Oh, what if she didn't like the cookies? And this, you like ruminate on this, and it keeps you up at night. I should have made oatmeal raisin, something like that. And also some moral reasoning is done here as well. This is not a bad network. It's just if this network isn't working at all, or if it's deficient, we see that in diseases like autism. We see that in Alzheimer's disease, where this is very underactive. But of course, someone who's very prideful, this area, the medial prefrontal cortex, that's self-referential thinking, they spend an enormous amount of time there. Okay? Other parts of the brain start getting activated too. So like the amygdala is our fear response. Like if a tiger jumps out, we suddenly have this fear response. The prideful person, they're trying to keep their ego elevated at all times. So everything seems like a threat. So any conversation seems like a threat. They're always on high alert. And it's obviously a, you know, not a desirable way to live. And this is closely related to vainglory. So glory isn't a bad thing. It's the public recognition of someone's goodness, especially with praise. But then there's, what does it mean to be vain? There are three ways, according to Thomas, that something can be vain. It can be false, so boasting about a talent you don't possess. So it's like, I'm really, really good at basketball. But then someone's like, hey, we're going to play basketball. It's like, well, I hurt my hamstring. And like every time you have an excuse, because you're really not good at basketball, right? Or it's fleeting. So you're just always thinking about your looks, your beauty. But eventually that fades. Or it's useless. So someone who, they can name all 50 capitals in alphabetical order backwards. And like every party they go to, it's like, watch this. And then they start naming the capitals backwards in alphabetical order. Like no matter where you bring them, that's what they do, right? That's vainglory. All right. All right. So, boasting what you don't really truly possess, that which is passing or that which is useless. It's seeking glory in the wrong way for the wrong reason. So pride says, I'm above others. Vainglory says, I want others to see that I'm above them. Okay. And then there are seven daughters to vainglory. Boasting, hypocrisy, audacity for novelties, obstinacy, discord, contention, and disobedience. I'll talk a little bit more about that. So this is kind of a cycle that occurs. You boast, you receive praise, you get a dopamine hit. Because of that, you form long-term potentiations, the behavior feels good, you do it again, it gets easier and more automatic as it's moving into the basal ganglia. Over time, this builds the habit of vice, both spiritually and neurologically. And this becomes like a worn trail that you continue. And the more you go down a trail, the easier it is to traverse. Okay? And then what happens is, like, we'll talk about this in the next slide, but, like, ultimately this is destructive. Like, we're aimed at objective goods, and if we're not seeking those objective goods, it's always destructive. So what happens here is you start to build tolerance. So you need like a higher hit. So then you start seeing someone who's prideful with vainglory starts doing shocking behaviors to get the same effect, right? It should be avoided. All right. This is very closely tied to addiction, although different. So when we talk about addiction, what happens with addiction is in your midbrain, there is this area called the ventral tegmental area. So if you do cocaine or heroin or online gambling, whatever it may be, the ventral tegmentum in the midbrain becomes stimulated and it releases a surge of dopamine to your nucleus accumbens. And that's your pleasure center. That's where this feeling of euphoria comes from. Okay? Reward and motivation come from that. Again, not a bad thing, but needs to be in moderation. So what happens is you get the drug, or whatever it may be, it activates the ventral tegmental area, then a dopamine surge to the nucleus accumbens. From the nucleus accumbens, there are pathways in this mesolimbic pathway that go to your amygdala, which has to do with emotions, and your hippocampus, which has to do with memory. So now there's an association with euphoria and emotional states, with places, with people, right? And then those become triggers, right? So every time you go to a certain place where you did X drug or a certain emotion that leads you to do something, well, now that becomes a trigger. And those triggers lead to cravings, which then causes you to seek out that same drug. And this will continue on, but as it continues on, you start to lose sensitivity to the receptors and the nucleus accumbens, and you get tolerance. So to have the same effect, now the same amount of dopamine is released, but there's not as many neurotransmitters. So you actually need more dopamine to have the same effect. So you have to do something more dramatic. Take a stronger drug. Take more of it, right? To have the same effect. And what happens is you can't possibly keep up with this. So then all your dopamine stores are low chronically, which leads to depression, personality changes. Your frontal lobe stops functioning properly. So you can no longer like deliberate very well. You can't suppress urges. So like people with frontal temporal dementia, for example, their frontal lobe starts to atrophy and stops to function. And now when they get urges, they just can't do anything but follow through with that urge. So they become very sexually inappropriate typically. So they'll make just countless sexually inappropriate comments in clinic. They may like lick people in elevators. Like they do a lot of weird things, right? And they really can't do otherwise because their frontal lobe just isn't working anymore, right? But drugs have a similar effect. This process starts to, you know, just destroy your frontal lobe. So it creates just more and more problems. It's important to realize that this is not just for drugs. So one of the things that this very commonly is related to, especially for men, is pornography. So it's the exact same thing. Like it works in the same area. So you know, someone watches pornography, the ventral tegmental area is now stimulated, dopamine rushes to the nucleus accumbens. Eventually, so certain triggers, emotional states lead you back to that behavior, so you continue to do it. Now the receptors are down-regulating within the nucleus accumbens, so now you need more and more stimulus to have the same effect, and then finally you actually enter into a real relationship, but it's impossible for that person to ever satisfy you, and then you're like 28 and you have erectile dysfunction, right? So like, it's the same thing. And then like your frontal lobe also starts to be affected where you cannot help but to see people as objects, right? Which is not good, because then you're abstracting away what's most important of the person. And these things begin as, to some extent, depending on your definition, a free act, like you choose to do this. But as you continue in this process, one's ability to choose their freedom dramatically diminishes, right? And they become enslaved to that thing, that substance or that action, right? True freedom is teleological, meaning for something to really be free, it needs to be aimed at an objective good, okay? That's just how we are wired. All right. So, humility. Let's kind of just see how I'm doing. I'm doing all right. All right. Humility. So this is viewing oneself truthfully in relation to God. You know your limits, you know your strengths, and you're willing to be subject to something greater. So Aquinas talks about this quite a bit in the Summa Theologiae, question 161. So there's a huge section on this that is beautifully written and worth reading. But this is having an accurate view of oneself before God. So like when I entered into medical school is very difficult. And when I entered in, I needed to pause and reflect upon my strengths and weaknesses. I needed to say, okay, I'm good at this, but these are areas that I really need to improve on. And these are weaknesses. And therefore, I need help. Like, I need to find people who have gone before me and done this. I need to talk to professors who are experts in this. I need X, Y, and Z resource to, like, help with these weaknesses so that I can become a good doctor, right? But if someone, I'm not saying I'm a humble person, but if you just completely lack humility, then you're in for a lot of surprises when you enter medical school. If you're like, I got this, like, I've done hard things. This is going to go great. It's not. Like, you're going to have a lot of difficulties. And teaching students, I just run into this a lot, right? It's like, I'm going to have ChatGPT tell me all these things. And then, like, they finally see a patient, and they have absolutely no idea what's wrong with the patient, right? So, you need to know your strengths. You need to know your weaknesses. You need to rely upon God's grace. You need to pray and all of these things, right? Magnanimity is an unfamiliar word to many. It's maybe more familiar to Catholics or Aristotelians, but it's a virtue that strengthens the mind, helping the person to overcome despair and pursue great goals with proper confidence in accordance with reason. So to give you maybe an example, again, not saying I'm a magnanimous person, but I've had moments, right? Like the donuts is a clear example of, you know, vice. So it was my first day being a neurology resident, and I drew the short straw, and I was on call for two thousand beds as a resident who had no experience, and I'm like 20 something. And has anyone seen that episode of Seinfeld where this guy walks out of, he like walks out of a bookstore or something. He says, "This is the first day of the rest of my life." And then he gets hit by a trolley and killed. That was this moment. I like pulled my car up in the parking lot and I was like, "This is the first day of the rest of my life," right? And I got a stroke alert as I was parking. Someone was having a stroke. So I rush into the emergency department. And there's this lady who has a devastating stroke. The two major arteries on both sides of her brain are blocked. Like I still have never seen this to this day, but we do the stroke scale saying the severity, and she maxed out on severity and she had the same stroke scale as a corpse. And so I'm like, her sister's there and we run through this. I'm going to give this clot busting medicine to try to like open up these clots. This is before we started doing procedures to mechanically remove the clots. The literature was saying we shouldn't do that, then it changed, and now we do that, and it's great, but this was before that. So, like, all right, lady's not doing well. So I get consent, go through the checklist, everything's good, give her the medicine, you know, there's no change. But then 2 hours later, I get a phone call, and she's hemorrhaging, like, everywhere. And this is my first day. So I call my staff, and I'm like, what do I do? I don't know what to do. I'm stuck. And he said, look it up. And that was it. And I was just like, I don't know where to look it up. So I ordered like fresh frozen plasma. It works, but I should have done cryoprecipitate. It's much faster. But it's like too late. This lady is going to die. And I was naive. Like there was no way she was going to survive to begin with, but I didn't know that. So anyway, she dies. It's the middle of the night and I'm counseling this whole family having an end of life conversation as like a 20 something year old by myself at 2 a.m. And I get another call, next patient dies, right? My first two patients die. And I'm just like up all night. It was incredibly difficult. And I was on for 30 something hours from when I started to when I went home. And I remember getting home and just being like, all right, this was fun. I'm done. Like, I can't do this anymore. And just sitting there and being like, okay, you know what though? Like, God has called me to be a doctor. Like, this is my vocation. This is what I'm meant to do. I remember like Sirach, the book of Sirach, has a whole chapter dedicated to being a physician, the noble profession of being a physician, chapter 38. It's wonderful reading. And I'm just reflecting upon the profession and just being like, this is a noble task. And this was a bad night. But like, I, you know, with God's help, with the gifts that he's given me, I can rely upon him and I can do this. And I was kind of like, should I quit or should I do this? And so then I said, okay, I'm going to do this because I believe that I can help patients. I believe that I can help my classmates and I can be a good doctor. So then from that day on, I just like got it. I'd come home from residency, and through that whole year, I went through one textbook after another, and I just wrote down everything I couldn't memorize. And I had all these binders or these kind of like notebooks that I'd keep in my pockets in my white coat. And I studied, I went through a whole stroke textbook, and then I went through epilepsy, and then neuromuscular, then neuroinfectious disease, then neuroophthalmology, then, you know, and on and on and on until I went through all of neurology and written down everything. And it took me a year or two to do that. And the whole rest of my residency was easy. Everyone gets so nervous when they're on call, and I was just like, let's go. Like, no matter what comes in, I am ready for this. Not because of pride, because God has equipped me for this. And like, I can do this, not for me, but for my patients, right? So as these things are happening, as we're learning, as we're forming habits, as we're doing all these things, these long-term potentiations are happening. And it's making us, it makes it easier to respond with humility rather than pride over time. It takes time. You need to be gracious with yourself. This takes weeks, months, years. Okay? It's a slow process. And then as we do that, as we grow in humility, the vice that corresponds to that pride will be pruned away. Okay? Not entirely. We're still going to struggle with sin, but it's going to get better. Okay? So when we talk about, okay, well, how? You know, how can we get better? How can we, you know, God has given us these potentials, you know, through his grace, through his church, through the works of Jesus Christ. Like, how can we actually get better? How can we become more Christ-like? Well, the wonderful thing is, yeah, that we just have so many tools. So some of the practical things that I do, so what's called the examine prayer, or specifically what I call the Thomistic examine, is at the end of my day, I lay in bed, and I consider the presence of God, and I ask the Lord, the Holy Spirit, to enlighten me and to clarify my day. And then I replay my day like a movie. And as I'm replaying the day with the movie, I'm doing so with the Lord, and I'm looking at objective truths. I'm looking at things like humility, things like pride, magnanimity. What went well? What didn't go well? I judge those actions in light of virtue. And then in seeing my failures and in seeing my success, I recognize the need for grace and that the good things that I'm able to do come from grace. They come from the Lord. I then proceed with gratitude. I thank the Lord for a number of things that he has done and blessed me with. And then I pray and hope for tomorrow, various patients I may see, interactions that didn't go as well as I wanted them to, that the Lord would give me grace for the next day to do this. And as we do this, there are certain benefits. These types of things have been studied. It improves our moral reasoning. It strengthens our emotional regulation. It fosters gratitude and joy and the effects that it has on the brain. It reduces rumination and anxiety, which suppresses our default mode network. It cultivates hope and future orientation, which has to do with the prefrontal and limbic integration. It deepens the sense of divine presence and meaning, and it makes your memory way better. So, like, as I reflect upon my day, I can still close my eyes and remember, like, a year and a half ago, like, a turn that I took on a particular street, and, like, the angle of my handlebars, and a homeless man I saw on the side and stopped and talked to him. Like, I still remember the motions that occurred. And it's like, as you do this, your memory becomes so sharp. Because one of like the almost tragedies, not tragedy, that may be too strong, but just like, as my kids grew up, I don't really remember them. I was in residency and I was like, I can remember like 10 things from those years and they're all bad. And like, and I regret not having these memories of like, you know, when my child rolled over or something like that. So it's just this, you forget these beautiful graces that the Lord gives you. So by remembering these things during the day, it's just easy to remember the goodness of God and his presence in your life. So that builds over time. And it becomes a very strong sense of awareness. Okay. The sacrament of reconciliation definitely improves humility if you've done this. So when you do an examine, you become much more aware of your shortcomings, of your sins. And we carry around with us this kind of cognitive dissonance, things we should have said but didn't, things that we said and should not have, moral failures. And these things increase our stress levels. They increase our cortisol levels. They increase anxiety and depression. And in being embodied human beings, we are meant to speak these truths. We are not meant to keep them just in our mind. They are meant to be expressed through the body because we are embodied. So there are obvious benefits of reconciliation, such as the forgiveness of sins, of course, but from just a neurological perspective, it is very good for us to do this. And one of the interesting, they did a study on partial confessions, so meaning that somebody did not confess the whole truth. It actually makes you much worse than having not confessed at all. Okay? So it's important that you get it all out there to someone who's not going to judge you, in which it's confidential. Just like patients come to me with their neurological issues, which they may be embarrassed about, they know that that will never leave the room, that that's safe with me. And it's important that when you confess, you have that same confidence, that this is between me and, you know, the Lord, and it may be through the priest, but it's very good for you. And of course, it helps you grow in humility. Just a couple more examples, and then I'll be done. Another example is praying the rosary. So I have a fear of flying. And this trip, I tried something different because I just read this study about praying the rosary. When you pray the rosary, your breathing rate slows to about 6 breaths per minute. And when that happens, it activates your autonomic nervous system, specifically your parasympathetic nervous system. And it decreases your cortisol levels, your heart rate, and the parasympathetic nervous system is the rest and digest. The sympathetic nervous system is like fight, flight, I forget the triad there. Freeze, right. Okay, so in a different order. It triggers the parasympathetic nervous system, and it has a calming effect. So I got on the plane this time, and I was like, I'm actually going to try this. And I'm like, this may look awkward, but I'm just going to like close my eyes and keep my rosary in my pocket, and I'm just going to like pray the rosary. The plane just like took off, and I was fine. And I was like, wow, why haven't I been doing this? This was amazing. One of the things with prayer, which makes it so difficult when it's unstructured, is our default mode network. We always want to collapse back into that and think about the self in a superficial way. We always want to mind wander. We always want to just go somewhere else into fantasy land, right? At least I do. But one of the good things about repetition, so as you pray the rosary, you're using the beads and, you know, you're saying the same thing over and over and over again. But as you do that, you're contemplating the life of Christ as you're doing that. So you're going maybe through the luminous mysteries. So you're thinking about Christ's incarnation, you're thinking about the Eucharist, you're thinking about these things. It actually allows one to focus on Christ and keep you kind of out of that default mode network as you're doing it. So it's very beneficial. And because one is focused on Christ, through Mary, they are exemplars of humility. So as you're praying this, you're growing in humility. And these are just some other kind of benefits of praying the rosary and kind of what part of the brain is involved. This is a Thomistic litany of humility, which I pray sometimes, but not as often as I should. But it's really a wonderful, it's humility and also magnanimity, which is an important component. So wonderful prayers. It's called A Thomistic Litany of Humility. It's from the Dominican Friars of the Providence of St. Joseph. Definitely worth having in your prayer life. And these are just some other activities. I won't go through them. But these are just some other activities that are very helpful for growing in humility, diminishing in pride. Of course, they have many other benefits. I'm just narrowly focusing on a few things. I also didn't mention Mass. But going to Mass, we're highly, highly individualistic in America. And one of the great things about Mass is we stand together, we sit together, we kneel together, we confess together. We pray together. We receive the same nourishment together in the Eucharist. And not just the people there, but also the whole body of Christ, which is one organism that stretches through time and space. It's like you start to appreciate others at the Mass as you kind of lose that hyper-individuality and you kind of enter into this organism, this body of Christ that's greater than yourself, and you start to really care about other people. I love just watching people go up to receive the Eucharist. You have such diversity in ages, ethnicities, people that are struggling to get up there, who have various handicaps. And it's wonderful to be like, yeah, that person's part of the body, and you can silently pray for them as they go. So it's really wonderful. So in summary, the brain changes through neuroplasticity. And this is true for habit formation as well, for better or worse. The good news is God's grace. So we do have freedom. We have an intellect. So we have the ability to know what is true. And we have a will to choose the good. And he has given us many tools through the merits of Christ and through his church to grow in virtue and diminish in humility. The other thing that I'll just maybe say in closing is one may wonder if this is in some sense futile. Eventually, as a neurologist, the brain stops getting healthier and you start losing neurons. There's still neuroplasticity, but the brain eventually fails and the person dies. However, I think that this process, when I think about it, this kind of teleological process of the brain is damaged and the human body will do, it seeks perfection. It does not attain that perfection, but it seeks that perfection. And it's a really beautiful thing. Like any illness, any injury, like that will happen. And that's wonderful. That's beautiful. And I think it's a foreshadowing of the resurrection, of our resurrection, of a body that will eventually reach that perfection in a supernatural way. And that, to me, is very encouraging. I'll end it there, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.